You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hello, and welcome to SpyCast from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Mark Stout, historian of the museum. I'm a PhD author and historian who served for 13 years as an analyst in the U.S. intelligence community. Every month, the museum brings you interesting talks with authors, scholars, and practitioners who have something to do with the world of intelligence and espionage. We're joined today by one of the country's leading intelligence historians. That's Matthew Aid. He's the author in 2010 of The Secret Century, The Untold History of the National Security Agency. Really a remarkable work. And now in January 2012, he has out his latest work, Intel Wars, The Secret History of the Fight Against Terror. Matthew Aid, welcome to the International Spy Museum.
Thank you.
Well, Matthew, as probably many of our listeners will know, they'll not only be familiar with your book about NSA, but know that, you know, more broadly, NSA and really studying the history of Cold War signals intelligence has been sort of your thing. So this book is a bit of a new direction for you. How did you come to write about Intel Wars and the war on terrorism?
Because I had started taking trips over to South Asia, to Afghanistan and Pakistan starting in 2008 as part of my work. I'm best known for writing, voluminous, tracks on signals intelligence. But, we live in a real world. And if you want to write about intelligence in the context of, what is it doing today? Then you have to, there are obviously very few declassified documents. And people here in Washington are very reluctant to speak unless, you're a member of the Washington Post. So what I thought about doing was, rather than write another book about, from the, the perspective of the, the conference table in the White House Situation Room, which has already been written, was actually to try and transport readers to the battlefields in Afghanistan and Pakistan, Iran, and elsewhere, and tell the story from the point of view of the intelligence operator and analyst, rather than another political book about how the President of the United States pushed this button and this happened 3,000 or 8,000 miles away. And so, I think the point I was trying to get across in writing this book is that, in the 10 years since 9/11, there's been a vast sea change in the U.S. intelligence community. I think most people suspect that, given the amount of money that has been pumped into it, over the last 10 years, and it has been now over 10 years since the 9/11 terrorist attacks, virtually every agency in the intelligence community has changed, and changed dramatically. They're larger. They're better funded. They're now about 210,000 men and women performing the intelligence function, both here in the United States and overseas. They're very well funded, and I think the most important point, there are sort of corollary points I wanted to make, is that contrary to a lot of the criticism of the intelligence community that came out in the 9/11 Commission. About, you had a bunch of, independent agencies that didn't work well with one another. Today's intelligence community is producing more and better intelligence than probably at any point in its history. And the analysis that is ending up on President Obama's desk is, I'd say, an order of magnitude better than it was a decade ago. More nuanced, you know, more detailed, and most importantly, right. I cite in the book examples of how the CIA, or you know, the CIA doesn't run the analytic program anymore. The national intelligence officers within the National Intelligence Council have written a number of very sober intelligence estimates over the last 3 years.
They have been a lot more pessimistic, or sober is the word you use, than what the administration's been saying publicly about
exactly.
the progress of Afghanistan and that sort of thing.
Exactly. Yes? And, you know, which, you know, is, I mean, that's the job of the intelligence community,
to speak truth to power.
Thank you. And, you know, I think the intelligence community has done a remarkably good job, especially on the big ticket items, meaning Afghanistan, Pakistan, the war on terror in general. I mean, there have been a few hiccups, like the national intelligence estimates that on Iran, for example, which are the subject of considerable controversy today. But the community had raw intelligence to back up its analysis. The problem is, you know, here in, we live here in Washington, where a lot of people oftentimes don't like the tenor and tone of what is contained in the reporting that comes out of the intelligence community. Well, you know, but that's their job. And so I wanted to tell that story, but also at the same time make the point that, all that being said, you know, better collection, better analysis, you know, there's more sharing of intelligence within the community, better product. We still, 10 years after 9/11, haven't fixed a lot of the fundamental flaws, structural flaws, within the intelligence community. This is the part where everybody immediately yawns and immediately switches channels. But I mean, this was one of the major criticisms by the 9/11 Commission. And we saw some of the problems when the former Director of National Intelligence, Admiral Dennis Blair, tried to rein in what he thought were some of the excesses of the CIA in terms of running the unmanned drone strike programs in Pakistan and some of their other activities. And Blair was overruled by the White House.
Yeah, you really paint Admiral Blair, briefly the Director of National Intelligence, President Obama's first DNI, as sort of a tragic figure, really.
I believe he was a tragic figure in the sense that whether you agree with his positions on key issues is, I mean, that's, you know, intelligent men and women do disagree on these subjects. But the fact is that, you know, at his core, he was trying to do what his job description said he was supposed to do, which was to be the intelligence czar of the United States. And it irked him to no end that, you know, some agencies, in particular the CIA, refused to acknowledge his authority as the Director of National Intelligence and continued to go off and do things on their own. And, you know, ultimately, I think it was the cause of his demise and untimely resignation from his job. So, yeah, I mean, in that sense, he is a tragic figure because, you know, I guess it's one of the beats I have, which is that if we want our intelligence system to work well, we need a strong leader at the top where all agencies work in harmony with one another, with one man beating the drum like a Roman slave galley. Yeah. And, you know, it's unfortunate, you know, American intelligence history is filled with, you know, strong-willed men at the top of agencies who really made a positive change in the way their agencies were run, like Walter Bedell Smith at the CIA, and there were Admiral Bobby Inman at NSA, and there have been others. And Blair was not given the opportunity to to provide the kind of strong leadership. Maybe he was the wrong person for the job. Maybe he wasn't, as much of an SOB as he needed to be, to hold that position. And now we have General Jim Clapper, who is not, making so many waves as his predecessor.
I want to turn just for a minute to NSA, because you have such remarkable depth of expertise with NSA. Do you want to talk for a moment about how NSA has adapted and changed since 9/11? What has NSA been up to, and are they similarly, your overall picture of the community, notwithstanding the caveat that you just gave, has been one of really strong performance. Do you think that applies to NSA specifically?
Oh, yeah. NSA, there are two agencies who have performed particularly well in the last decade. One is the CIA, which has done remarkable work in some parts of the world. But the National Security Agency has had some remarkable technical successes in the last 10 years, which, of course, must remain unacknowledged in order to ensure that, these programs are not compromised in any way. But it's clear that cyber war, as many people call it, the ability to reach out and get into somebody's computer, that's the new cryptologic fashion du jour up at the National Security Agency. The days of the big listening posts and the gigantic antennas and thousands of boys and girls crammed into sweaty listening posts listening to radio traffic, those days are essentially gone now. NSA has re-engineered itself into a cyber intelligence gathering organization. It's faster, it's leaner, and the kind of intelligence it's producing, especially on terrorist targets, is by all accounts quite remarkable.
So are you suggesting then that NSA has adapted itself from being an organization that's primarily devoted to stealing information in motion, i.e. information when it's being transmitted, when I pick up the phone and make a phone call, or when a foreign ministry sends a cable, to one that's primarily devoted to stealing data at rest, i.e. data that's just sitting on a hard drive or on a server somewhere in a server farm in pick your favorite country?
No, actually, as I understand it, the collection process, the signals intelligence collection process today is very dynamic. It's NSA is not just, getting into somebody's hard drive and vacuuming out, the contents. Emails are being intercepted and read in real time thanks to some incredibly sophisticated software packages that have been produced in the last decade. There's digital data streams that are coursing around the world or through satellites or underwater, cables, fiber optic systems. They're all being exploited by NSA. Also, that's at the strategic level. But at the tactical level, in Afghanistan and until recently in Iraq and other places around the world, you have military intercept teams providing real-time intelligence to combat commanders down to the company level, which is unheard of, or was unheard of 10 years ago. But now you have battalion and company commanders that are getting real-time signals intelligence, which is defining and shaping the battle, the battle space today, all over the world. So, it's a remarkable change that has taken place.
You mentioned CIA as being the other organization that you thought had really particularly stepped up to the plate. The first thing that most Americans think about when they think about CIA is it's the agency that primarily, not exclusively, but primarily conducts espionage for us. Do you have any sense, or have we done recruiting sources inside Al-Qaeda?
If the people who know, obviously would not have told me, this would rate, several code words above my unclassified clearance level. I don't know what I don't know, and that's perfectly proper. What I do know is that, particularly in the Middle East, South Asia, and some of the battlefields in Asia, where militant terrorist groups have been very active, and I'm thinking in terms of the Philippines, Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, the CIA has been very active and very successful in terms of providing, collecting and providing intelligence to consumers about what the bad guys are up to. For example, in the Philippines, the terrorist group Abu Sayyaf, which is, you know, generally accepted to be an affiliate of Al-Qaeda, has basically been decimated over the past 10 years by very good intelligence work, in part by the CIA, but also by military intelligence teams, you know, working out in the field along with Philippine troops, you know, to destroy this organization.
One of the big controversies about the Iraq War, well, one of many controversies about the Iraq War, was the claim that it supposedly diverted scarce intelligence resources from Afghanistan, where they were, you know, deep in the fight against Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda Central, and against the Taliban. Is this a, laying aside other issues relating to the Iraq War, is that a fair critique in and of itself?
I think just at a generic level, it's a fair critique. You talk to the operators in the field, the collectors, and they will tell you that, well, you know, back in, you know, the earlier, you know, like 8-9 years ago, I mean, resources were scarce. And so, and the number of people who spoke Arabic or Pashto or Dari or some of the other arcane languages spoken in that part of the world were really in short supply. And particularly those individuals whose linguistic talents were sophisticated enough to understand slang or whose analytic knowledge of the region was, you know, above just basic reading the New York Times and Washington Post. So, yeah, I mean, there was some diversion of assets away from Afghanistan after we invaded the country in the October of 2001. And I think at an analytic level, you know, I'm differentiating between collectors and analysts here. What happened is a lot of the people working, you know, in the National Intelligence Council who ordinarily would have continued to focus on the terrorist aspects in Afghanistan got shunted over to, more urgent targets, meaning Iraq and that region. And so we lost continuity coverage.
You want to explain the importance of continuity coverage? What do you mean by that?
Continuity coverage simply means you maintain a constant state of vigilance on a high priority target. And, you know, but, you know, we live in a day, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if we lived in a world where, you know, you had sufficient resources, both money and trained personnel, where you could keep fixed on a target with no, you know, no slippage in coverage based on the vagaries of you know, geopolitical events taking place around the world. That's not the world we live in. In fact, the intelligence community has a nasty habit of taking resources from one problem to handle the crisis du jour. And the phrase that is often used is surge. We will surge resources into the Iraq problem, but we'll take the resources out of Afghanistan or Pakistan.
So on the one hand, we've got a really unprecedentedly large intelligence community now. I think you gave the figure of something on the order of 210,000 people. But on the other hand, what I think I hear you saying is that for a lot of these problems, it really boils down to making these numbers up. But we need people with, you know, fluent level native Dari, and there's six of them in the entire community. That, you know, the overall figure of $80 billion and something like that and 210,000 people is sort of misleading for a lot of specific problems on a particular date in a particular place.
Absolutely true. And now, you know, just to address to the language, you know, issue which you hearken to, 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, we had so few people who spoke the three languages spoken in Afghanistan that we literally had to fly recruiters out to Fremont, California, which is the home of the largest population of Afghanis in the United States and offer these gentlemen, most of whom were in their 40s or 50s and were not trained spies, $100,000 plus contracts to come and sit in NSA listening posts with headphones on and listen to what their countrymen 8,000 miles away were saying into their walkie-talkies. That's how desperate we were for personnel. Since that time, our language schools have cranked out hundreds, if not thousands, of reasonably talented language experts, and over time they'll get more, you know, they'll get better skilled in their respective languages, assuming they don't get taken out of that language and told to learn something else, and they're allowed to become experts in their field. So we now were depending on contractors to a far lesser degree than we were 5 years ago for those arcane skills which is what we desperately needed.
So we've finally had the time to grow those skills inside the government itself.
Absolutely correct.
We've been talking about Afghanistan here for a minute. Of course, the big stories these days out of Afghanistan and Pakistan, which are basically inseparable problems in one sense, is the campaign of drone strikes against Al-Qaeda, Taliban, and other similar sorts of targets, particularly in Afghanistan. Now, obviously, at the tactical level, these have been pretty successful, i.e., when we're pretty good at identifying targets, and when we shoot at you, you're probably going to die.
Yes.
but in a bigger picture sense, sort of in the operational and strategic level, is this getting us anything? Is this getting us any closer to victory? The Americans have in the military and you could argue in the intelligence realm a great history of technical and tactical success, but not necessarily so good at making it all add up to anything. What's your assessment on the drone issue specifically?
Well, the drone, I'll take. You're absolutely right. On the battlefields in Afghanistan and previously in Iraq, these drones flying 10,000 feet, they literally can, put a missile on home plate at Yankee Stadium, flying at the same altitude as a jetliner, which is, a remarkable skill. They can provide vast amounts of intelligence information, so much so that they literally are swamping the analysts with too much data. But in the case of Pakistan, you have two schools of thought. You have some of the senior officials at CIA headquarters who believe that the drone has basically all by itself been largely responsible for the destruction or the near destruction of Al-Qaeda. It's true. If you do the body count, and I hate body counts, because they tell you absolutely nothing, and they're a very poor measuring stick for determining whether you're winning or losing a war. But the boys out at Langley love metrics, and they love to be able to say, "Well, we've." And President Obama, just a couple days ago, was criticized for being weak in the war on terror, and his response was, "Well, we've killed." We killed Osama bin Laden on May 1st of this year, and we've taken out 22 of the top 30 Al-Qaeda leaders. Absolutely true. But a lot of the lower-level analysts at the Director of National Intelligence Office and even at Langley and the State Department believe that these drone strikes have created just as many problems as they have solved, particularly the Pakistani government. Everyone knows that our relationship with the Pakistani government has been deteriorating rapidly for probably the last 3 years, but in particular in 2011 was a very bad year. And the relationship has gotten to the point now where the CIA has now had to suspend drone operations over Pakistan for significant periods of time because the Pakistani military would no longer give us overflight rights over their country. And this happened after Osama bin Laden was killed in May. There was a several week hiatus in drone strikes. And more recently, last month, U.S. warplanes and helicopter gunships killed 24 Pakistani border guards. And since that horrific incident, there have been no drone strikes for the last 6 weeks. The CIA says, well, we've suspended the operations, but the truth is the Pakistanis won't let us fly over their airspace anymore. And, you know, so, I mean, this is just part of the problem. You know, we're down to the what some of my friends in the community call the nub. There are very few targets left, you know, in northern Pakistan, you know, Al-Qaeda officials and soldiers hiding away. We're down to the point where it's almost a law of diminishing return. You keep two or three drones flying 24/7 over northern Pakistan, and they maybe take a shot once a week at a target. So we're reaching the point of diminishing returns.
You quoted a senior U.S. intelligence official in your book as saying something in this connection that I found absolutely striking. And you quoted this person as saying, quote, "Capturing Al-Qaeda officials is a bother. It's so much easier just to kill them when you find them." And I'm wondering if what the import of this is. I mean, I would read that as saying that because as a country we have been unable to come up with a way that we find legally, morally, and politically sustainable to handle prisoners, that now instead of capturing people, we just blow them to little tiny bits. Is that basically what's going on here, or am I being too cynical?
Well, your cynicism usually has some basis in fact, and you know, opinion varies widely on this subject, but I think the facts speak for themselves. We have not captured a senior Al-Qaeda or even a middle-level Al-Qaeda official probably in going on 6 or 7 years now. We've killed hundreds, if not thousands, of Al-Qaeda foot soldiers and, you know, bomb makers and senior officials, including Osama bin Laden. But, you know, you don't see a lot of effort being made by the intelligence community or the military to actually capture these guys.
Which I find fascinating because you can get all sorts of intelligence benefits
right
when you capture someone,
right.
Which usually can't get when you blow them up.
Exactly. I mean, we're looking at this problem as former intelligence analysts, which is, you know, the gist for our mill to understand our enemy, you know, our target is, you know, interrogation. I mean, you know, to actually talk to these people and get intelligence out of them about, you know, the enemy, what is their state, you know, what is their strength, capabilities. And if you're not capturing any of these people, there's sort of like a giant hole in your knowledge base about, you know, the enemy that we claim to be fighting and trying to destroy. So, I mean, you know, at that level, there's a real problem. But I think from a political point of view, you know, you have to remember that President Obama promised to, quote, you know, close the Guantanamo Bay detention facility in his first week in office. It's still going strong. There have been no prosecutions of any of the captured Al-Qaeda terrorists now being held at Guantanamo, again, for a variety of political and legal issues. And so, yeah, you can understand why, you know, a senior, you know, White House official would say it's just too much of a bother, both politically, you know, we capture one of these people and suddenly, you know, it's like attracting flack. You know, it's so much easier, simpler, you know, no brouhaha, just blow them to smithereens.
Last couple of questions here. I want to turn a little bit more to the home front. First, sort of a smaller question. You had a fascinating section in the book where you talked about a fleet of FBI aircraft operating secretly in Virginia. You want to tell us a little bit about that, and how did you get onto this story?
It's not much of a secret if someone like myself can get hold of it. And how I came about, I live in Washington, D.C. I like to go out on my balcony and have coffee in the morning. And I kept noticing that these helicopters were flying back and forth over northwest D.C. And, since 9/11, no civil aircraft can fly over Washington, D.C., only government planes and helicopters. And they were buzzing around my neighborhood like flies around in a bad steak. And so what I started doing is taking down the tail numbers of the helicopters as they flew their missions. And, you know, you can go to the the Federal Aviation Administration's database of all aircraft in the United States, and you put in the tail number of the aircraft or helicopter, and it tells you who owns it. And it turns out that all of these helicopters or aircraft were owned by five proprietary companies, you know, basically front companies that had been set up during the Clinton administration in the 1990s to own and operate over 130 aircraft and helicopters that the FBI uses to conduct surveillance in the United States.
So why are they flying over Northwest Washington?
Are
they watching you, Matthew?
No, I have no doubt that I'm of little, if any, interest to the law enforcement community of the United States. But the question is valid. I mean, Northwest D.C. is the home of power brokers, lawyers, accountants, congressmen, and senators, and pretty women hanging out by swimming pools. And is there an Al-Qaeda presence in Northwest Washington that I don't know about?
Well, along those lines, you did mention that there was a bit of a disagreement, as you saw it, between the FBI on the one hand and most of the rest of the intelligence community on the other hand about the extent of the domestic threat posed by domestic Islamist terrorists, of the Al-Qaeda ilk. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, I wish for the sake of posterity that we were back in the business of offering unclassified summaries of national intelligence estimates on key topics. But most of the, in fact, all of the national intelligence estimates that have been produced by the intelligence community over the past decade on, the war on terror, always have a section on domestic terrorism. And invariably, the community has, the analysts have reached a consensus opinion that say, well, there's still very much the, there's a problem with lone wolf terrorists, disenchanted individual packing his station wagon with ammonium nitrate and trying to blow up Times Square, which has, almost happened.
Sounds vaguely familiar.
Yes, it does. But in terms of whether there's a network of Al-Qaeda sleeper cells, or is there a terrorist infrastructure hiding beneath the surface, the surface of urban and rural America, the intelligence community takes the position and has consistently held this position. No, I mean, we searched and searched for years after 9/11 and could not find any evidence of Al-Qaeda sleeper cells or networks or infrastructures comparable to what was found in Europe at the time. The FBI took the position, basically rejected the findings and said, look, that's wonderful that you CIA and DIA analysts have come to that conclusion, but we are the domestic security agency of the United States, and we're going to do whatever it takes to make sure that there are no more 9/11s, which, basically means, they continue to focus on the issue to the exclusion of many other things.
Well, let's take that then to the last question. Do you think that we are likely to be surprised again by another 9/11 style attack, not necessarily hijacking, but another dramatic attack? Or broadly speaking, is the intelligence community really on top of this problem enough that we're not likely to be surprised?
Well, in terms of the foreign threat, from Al-Qaeda or the proliferating number of affiliates, we just saw a terrorist attack by a group in Nigeria called Boko Haram, which nobody has paid any attention to. I think from the threat from overseas, by international terrorist groups, has been beaten down to the point where the threat is low, but it still exists. And we're always, from this point for the rest of our lives and our children's lives, we're going to have to invest huge sums of money to make sure that there are no more 9/11s being planned and executed from abroad. I think more realistically, the threat that we as Americans face is already here in the United States in the form of angry, disenchanted individuals another Timothy McVeigh, to use an example. Probably an American citizen born here or emigrated here. The profile is indistinct, but I think, I think most of the analysts that I've spoken to believe that, if there is going to be another terrorist outrage in the United States, it probably will come from within rather than from without.
Well, Matthew Aid, you've done it again. Another fabulous piece of work on some of the most secret but also most important doings of the U.S. government. Again, for our listeners, his new book is Intel Wars, The Secret History of the Fight Against Terrorism. Matthew Aid, thank you so much, and come back again to the International Spy Museum.
Thank you very much.
We look forward to continuing this dialogue with you, and we'd like to know if you have any comments or questions on today's SpyCast. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum.org. Thank you, and we'll see you next month.